and welcome. Judge Tinder and I would also like to welcome Judge John DiGiulio from Northern Indiana, who is sitting with us by designation today. We're delighted to have him here. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
All right, we'll start this morning with our first case, number 11-1957, McReynolds v. Merrill Lynch. Ms. Friedman.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the Court. In the 47 years since Title VII was enacted, not one court other than the district court below has ever dismissed with prejudice on the pleadings a compensation discrimination complaint pursuant to Section 703H of Title VII.
Well, there's always a first time.
Yes. As the employer organizations who filed briefs in support of the affirmance have acknowledged, incentive compensation plans are used by millions of workers in financial services, real estate, insurance, and retail sales. Also, countless employers use systems that measure the quantitative or qualitative goals that are achieved, and according to the defendant, all of these employers would be immune from suit unless the plaintiff was able to show that the systems under which the employees were measured were adopted for the purpose of discriminating. So if this is the law, the question that must be posed is why in 47 years has there not been another district court who has dismissed a case on the pleadings under 703H, and perhaps better yet, why does not every defendant entering court as a matter of course file a Rule 703H motion in response to any discrimination complaint? The answer to the question is that the district court was wrong as a matter of law in finding these defendants immune from suit under 703H. This decision flies in the face of the legislative history of Title VII, the legislative history of 703H, decades of governing precedent, and subsequent legislation, which includes the Lilly Ledbetter Act and the 1991 Civil Rights Act, as well as Rule 8 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure.
You're leaving out another important legal development in the meantime, which is Twombly-Iqbal. And I think this case needs to be seen through that lens.
We're happy to look at this case through that lens, Your Honor. And we anticipated that the defendant would argue that 45 of the 47 years are irrelevant because they were pre-Iqbal. And that's an area where we think that the district court also made an error, and that is in determining what is the proper plausibility standard that ought to apply in a discrimination case. And there are two ways that that question can be asked. The first way that the question can be asked is it plausible that a defendant would act against its business interests and engage in this conduct? And under that analysis, you can come up with an answer like Bank of America would not have wanted to be sued again by these plaintiffs, so it isn't plausible that they would have engaged in discriminatory conduct. But we would suggest that the proper way in a discrimination complaint to view the plausibility question is to ask whether it's plausible that a defendant who was engaged in discrimination would do it this way. And the analogy would be if you looked at a criminal indictment and you asked the question, is it plausible that anybody would do this if they knew they would go to jail? You would get one answer. But if you asked the question, is it plausible that someone with a criminal mind might carry out the crime in this way, you would get a different answer.
Counsel, let me ask, do you believe that the program on its face is racially neutral, and only because of alleged past discrimination it has a disparate impact?
No, and there's some technical parts to that answer that I'd be happy to go through, but it has more to do with how the compensation credits are tallied.
But let me ask it this way. If not for the alleged past discrimination, would this program produce a disparate impact?
Yes.
Okay. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. In the financial services industry, financial advisors are compensated based on a grid which assigns values to the transactions that they undertake on behalf of their clients. And, of course, the heart of this case is that For decades, Merrill Lynch has resisted hiring African Americans and integrating African Americans in a productive way so that they could earn comparable production credits. And that disparate impact claim does go to the question of whether or not the firm steers the resources, meaning the client accounts and the leads and the referrals and the departing brokers' books and IPOs, sales assistance, managerial support towards whites instead of towards African Americans, because Merrill Lynch perceives that its clients prefer to deal with whites rather than African Americans. That's the disparate impact claim.
That's your first case?
Yes.
Is that what is called McReynolds 1?
That is a significant part of McReynolds 1. In addition to that, and this is where the disparate impact would come in specifically under the policy, there are judgment calls that are made as to how to quantify the credits. And what the plaintiffs allege is that in addition to rigging the production credit by steering the accounts, that the tally of the credits is racially discriminatory. And an example that we could give would be when you look at how points are given, more points are given under the pay system for trading stock than buying a mortgage. And Merrill Lynch has done internal studies and confirmed that African American clients and African American brokers transact business more in terms of the mortgages than the sale of stock. And when revenue points are assigned, meaning how profitable it is for the firm, the revenue is higher in the mortgage than it is in the stock. So that would be sort of a side part of the case. And we, in the case below, we identified three different areas that we thought were intentionally racially discriminatory about the assignment, which were the small ticket items, which had to do with the household wealth, this notion of in addition, the house, how many people were in the household and how large the household was versus the size of the ticket, as well as the type of product that's being purchased. And we believe that some of the discrimination that comes in, he has to do with distrust of the stock market and other factors like that. So when we responded below in McReynolds 1 to the question of whether or not the grid and the underlying way in which production was tallied was intentionally discriminatory, we did point to some of the features that we believe have a race effect independent of this steering of the account distributions. But the gravamen of the claim is asking the question of whether an employer can rig the system by assigning and steering these accounts to one race rather than the other race, and then take cover under a provision that we believe was intended to address a very specific and different context. And if you go back to legislative history of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, what was going on was a debate over whether or not this law should even exist and whether or not employers should be required to integrate and to hire women and to hire minorities. And so this section was an attempt to comfort and calm the concerns by saying nothing will change after this law is passed. It is not true that if African Americans are hired or women are hired, that you won't be able to keep the people who are the most senior. Those seniority provisions will remain intact. It is also not true that you will not, if you work in a piecework type system where two people are building widgets next to each other, that you will not be able to keep the worker who can build more widgets.
Well, 703H is not limited to piecework.
We take
seniority systems alone. It's phrased more broadly than that. Any production-based compensation system is protected within its safe harbor unless the production-based compensation system is itself motivated by discriminatory intent.
We don't agree with that reading. I think if you go back to the legislative history, and we've cited in our briefs,
the statute.
The text of the statute refers.
It does not exclude this. It refers to production-based compensation systems generally. It doesn't say piecework or contain any limitation at all that would restrict it to the production of manufactured goods.
The text of the statute refers to quantity and quality.
Quantity and quality, production-based compensation systems, right, which covers this on its face. So we don't have to get to the legislative history.
It also has a word bona fide, which from our perspective modifies whether or not quantity and quality is being measured. So in many of the Supreme
argument,
it's a variation on the argument. So yes, it is quantity and quality, but in order for it to be bona fide, it must measure what it purports to measure.
Bona fide modifies seniority system, not the production-based quantity and quality compensation system.
If you look at the language of the statute and how it relates to the different factors, and you think about a seniority system always measures year to year to year. There isn't a question about whether that's a thing that measured what it purports to measure. When you get to the question of an exam or a performance evaluation system, you have to test the system to see whether it measures what it purports to measure. It doesn't matter whether you put the word bona fide in front of it or if you just ask the question broadly, which is this a system that measures quantity and quality of production?
That's fair. That's a better argument.
And what we would argue is that that's where you get into these nuances. And you, in a continuum, clearly if two people are building widgets next to each other and one builds more widgets than the other, that's a very simple, easy example. They go to the cash register, they turn in their widgets, and they get a check. Where you get into the situation that's in this case, which is like if you have a man or a woman building widgets next to each other, and they go to the cash register, and someone taps the man on the shoulder and says, here's a few widgets. These are widgets that we had already built in the factory that we're going to assign to you. There are some leads. There are some referrals. We're going to let you even team with another person, perhaps a man who would like to mentor you or because you're a young man and he sees some relationship and affinity towards you and he lends you his widgets. So when you get to the cash station and you're checking out your widgets, in our example, African Americans are standing in a line only holding the widgets that they built, and whites are standing in a completely different line checking out widgets that they built and also widgets that were lent to them, that were given to them,
sure,
that were assigned to them.
Yeah,
so it's not quantity or quality. But I think it doesn't matter how you get there, whether you say bona fide modifies or you inject in the question of quantity or quality, is this or is this not quantity or quality, you get to the same place.
Right. It matters as a matter of statutory interpretation and what the different provisions of 703H mean, you know, as a threshold matter. But, you know, for purposes of the facts that are alleged in this case, I get the distinction that you're drawing, and the conduct that you're describing is independently actionable and, in fact, is being litigated in McReynolds 1, back to Judge Tinder's question. And what we have here is just a narrow focus on the retention bonus, which unless you've alleged that it doesn't actually measure production, is entitled to the safe harbor provision.
And
so I need to hear your best argument for how this system, and tie it to what you've alleged in the complaint, how this retention bonus plan doesn't, in fact, measure production.
It doesn't measure production because, as we've alleged in the complaint, Merrill Lynch, for almost 40 years, has treated African Americans differently and less favorably.
And that conduct is independently actionable and is being litigated.
I think that that's an interesting question that I would like to address. And that is a question is, why bring McReynolds 1 and bring McReynolds 2? Why are they separate?
Why isn't this relief that Judge Gettleman could give you in McReynolds 1?
I think that's really the heart of this. And I would suggest that I think, Your Honor, what you stated, which is a matter of statutory construction, which is the best way to go about it, separating these questions, which is there a viable cause of action? And should the district court's decision be reversed because the district court dismissed a pleading that contains a viable cause of action, is the right way to approach this case? Because if you approach it any other way, it becomes precedent that can be used in another case. For example, if you approach the case and say,
it doesn't become precedent until we rule on it.
Well, if it's sustained on the basis that the district court ordered, which is that you can only challenge the inputs, it leaves a person like Lily Ledbetter with no claim. She would have been sent back to challenge the performance evaluation, which was time-barred. And she would not have been able to bring that case and then seek as damages her wage.
That's a different question. That's a statute of limitations issue. That's a when question. That's not a what question. And what we're dealing with here is a what question, not a when question.
You have to have the underlying claim to be able to get the liability. So let me go back to the question that we posed, which is why would you bring both lawsuits? I think as a matter of law, it's important to understand that a civil rights claim or cause of action is a personal injury. So for these plaintiffs, when they walked in George McReynolds after 28 years of working at Merrill Lynch and learned that he was not going to get a bonus and that the whites who had been favored for all of these years would be taking home paychecks of hundreds of thousands of dollars, it was a personal injury. Much in the same way that if you drive a car and you run over someone, you don't get to go kick them in the gut just because you may already be on the hook for lost back pay. So independently, we believe it's actionable as compensation discrimination. You would bring it as a separate lawsuit because it impacts the declaratory and the injunctive relief. It may be that in a class action situation, this is an easier class to certify. It's only 120 people. They were all current. There are no formers in this particular claim. You could take a very simple mathematical analysis and comparison of the whites that were awarded the bonuses versus African Americans, capture that pool of money, and pursuant to this court's well-established lost opportunity doctrine, collect those wages and distribute them fairly. McReynolds 1 is now an individual case. It's not a class action. The judge denied class action status. So each plaintiff will have to prove up their claim for damages on the inputs, tally them all up, and have those damages equal what they would have received on the bonus, as opposed to independently challenging the bonus and throwing the bonus out as being an unlawful employment practice.
Well, to the extent that the bonus reflects or locks in continuing discrimination, there's a remedy for that in the underlying litigation, the McReynolds 1 litigation. It's just an individual remedy. So is the point you're making confined to the class action device?
It isn't only the class action device. It's not only past discrimination. It was a continuing discrimination, that bonus. It was, under the Ledbetter Act, an unlawful employment practice in and of itself. And an unlawful employment practice that, if you're looking at this complaint, we would ask that you judge this complaint not looking at whether McReynolds 1 is pending, but ask the question, if these plaintiffs had never brought McReynolds 1, would McReynolds 2 meet the standards of Iqbal, and would it be a viable cause of action under 703H? And we believe that's the better legal approach. If, in fact, the answer to that question is the judge should not have dismissed the case because the plaintiffs adequately alleged and put at issue in the pleadings and were entitled to prove whether or not this bonus program computed quantity or quality, or even, as Judge Connelly found, we had alleged that it was intentionally adopted for discrimination because Judge Connelly sustained that allegation, then the complaint should be sustained. The next question that should be asked is a procedural question. What's the best way to handle McReynolds 1 and McReynolds 2? Is it to ask the plaintiffs to amend McReynolds 1, to add a new count? That would have been problematic because of how far we were in litigation. We were past discovery. Class petitions had been filed. We were adding a new defendant, Bank of America, in its own, for its own conduct, not only as a successor employer. And so the question would have been, should it be another count in the complaint? Or should the two lawsuits be filed separately to give the EEOC notice of the separate employment discrimination alleged, and then related, which is what happened in this case. But when you ask the question of whether or not McReynolds 2 is sustainable as a matter of law, and you factor into that analysis that McReynolds 1 is already pending, it makes bad law. Because the next person who comes along is faced with a case that says you can't challenge the bonus, you can only challenge the inputs. And if that person has not challenged the inputs because the time period has expired to challenge the inputs, remembering that under Title VII it's only 300 days, then you've made bad law. And the law then is that there is no such thing as a compensation discrimination complaint. Instead, everything must be pled as a challenge to an input, which takes you right back to where the law was under the Ledbetter decision before the Ledbetter Fair Pay Act.
Well, isn't that the thrust of the Teamsters case, that you, that the system itself is protected even if the underlying conduct is not?
Only because the allegation in Teamsters was that the system was not adopted for the purpose of discriminating,
that
and
was conceded in that case.
And also that it measured what it purported to measure. So that is the critical distinction between seniority, which is easy. And in fact, when Congress in 1991 rewrote the Civil Rights Act in response to the Lawrence case, the language in that act specifically says for a seniority system that is adopted for discrimination. But yet when compensation was written, it was written to allow, as this court found in Randell, claims for perpetuating the past discrimination. So this bonus claim falls as an unlawful employment practice under the Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. It appropriately challenged whether or not quantity or quality was measured or tainted, and it should have been allowed to go forward. That's the best result, and one that's most consistent with the legislative history of Title VII, which was to protect these rights, the legislative history of 703H, which was to provide a measure of protection to employer, but not to just allow the employer to come up and say, you know, this is a merit system. And it's also consistent with 40 years of precedent.
I'd like to stop you there, Ms. Friedman. You've run out of time, but I'll give you a couple minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Dinloff.
Good morning. If it pleases the court, I think the court has it exactly right that this case needs to be viewed through the lens of Twombly and Iqbal. And I think it's important to keep in mind the context in which this program was adopted as alleged in the complaint, considering that plausibility. The complaint alleges that Merrill Lynch, a 100-year institution, is going out of business, and in September of 2008 is acquired for $50 billion by Bank of America. In the context of that acquisition, Merrill Lynch and Bank of America decide that they need to institute a retention program to retain the most productive of the 15,000 financial advisors who were a crown jewel in that acquisition. And in that context, they decide, coming up with the only possible solution that any rational employer would come up with, which is to award greater bonuses to more productive brokers than to less productive brokers, and to give no bonuses to the least productive brokers at all. That is the program at issue, and that is the context in which this program was adopted. And I submit that in that context, plaintiff needs to allege facts that establish that despite what is the most plausible explanation, which is that the program was not adopted for discriminatory reasons, they must allege sufficient facts to create a plausible story that, in fact, it was adopted for discriminatory reasons. But in the end of the day, plaintiffs are not making that argument.
Have you taken a position in McReynolds 1 as to whether this bonus could be captured as part of the remedy, could be corrected as part of the remedy in McReynolds 1?
That question has not come up, but our position is that it can. We've taken that position in this case, that is, in fact, exactly what plaintiffs should and are entitled to do. If an individual class member establishes that he or she was the victim of discrimination, and if those discriminatory acts took place within the statute of limitations period, then, in fact, the bonus is an element of their damages. And that's exactly the teaching of Teamsters. For plaintiffs to prevail in this case, they must literally reverse 34 years of jurisprudence and find that, in fact, discriminatory inputs render a system otherwise protected by 703H as invalid. The Supreme Court has reiterated this principle time and time again, repeatedly over those 34 years since Teamsters was decided. And that principle has guided 703H jurisprudence for well over three decades.
There isn't a whole lot out there on compensation systems other than seniority systems. Is there any distinction in how 703H applies?
I think only in the way that Your Honor articulated earlier, which is that the word bona fide does not apply to production-based systems. And I think the reason for that is that a production-based system, by definition, is bona fide. Because the definition of bona fide in the seniority context, as the Supreme Court found in Teamsters, is a system that applies on its face equally to all employees, race-neutral, gender-neutral. And in answer to Your Honor's question earlier to Ms. Friedman, her answer to your question, when she got into the facts of that answer, quite clearly demonstrate that, in fact, the system applies equally to everybody, regardless of race or gender, that their arguments about the system have to do with the inputs into that system, not with whether the system itself applies equally to whites and blacks. And in fact, the reason, and I think the reason the Supreme Court has given for drawing this distinction between inputs and the system itself is demonstrated quite clearly here. In Teamsters, the Supreme Court said that one of the reasons we are drawing a distinction between the system itself and the inputs into the system is because the people who are victims of discrimination can in fact obtain full relief by challenging the underlying inputs. And that is clearly the case here as well. Just like in Teamsters, it was possible to alter the seniority system, to order the seniority rankings to give somebody who had been discriminated against a higher seniority ranking under Bauman. Here, quite clearly, anybody who establishes that they were a victim of discrimination will be able to use the retention bonus program as a measure of that discrimination and a measure of their damages.
But I think you conceded that their claim would also be actionable if they could plausibly plead that Merrill Lynch adopted this program with the intent to discriminate.
Yes,
not just that they were aware, based on past alleged discrimination, it might discriminate, but with the intent to discriminate.
That's correct. I think that is the specific exception set forth in 703H. And I submit here two things. One, given the context that they've alleged in the complaint, it's simply not plausible that that's what happened here. But secondly, and equally importantly, it's important to understand how plaintiffs have pled the intent to discriminate. The plaintiffs here have quite clearly pled that the intent to discriminate flows from the fact that production credits are tainted by discrimination, and it quotes quite and equally from the fact that Merrill Lynch allegedly knew that the production credits were tainted by discrimination. That is the intent pled quite specifically in the complaint. And that is specifically barred by the case law of the Supreme Court and of this Court.
So what would they have to plead to be able to show that the program was adopted with the intent to discriminate?
That the retention program itself was specifically manipulated in such a way as to disadvantage African Americans. But here, in a production system, in a system and in a program that applies equally, by its very terms, in a very obvious and rational manner, to every employee equally, that program is protected by 703H. And the reason why it's protected by 703H is, just think about this program and think about what kind of program Merrill Lynch should have adopted in order to avoid this lawsuit. It's almost inconceivable that they could come up with any other program. And what 703H was designed to do was to avoid putting employers in that very box, where it has to go through extraordinarily expensive and lengthy discovery in order to ultimately prevail in a case such as this.
Well, if McReynolds 1 had been completed, could they go ahead then and formulate a retention system with that in the past?
Merrill Lynch, if I'm not sure I understand follow Your Honor's question.
That's not a very good question.
If your question is, if Merrill Lynch had been found guilty of discrimination in McReynolds 1, could it still have adopted this program?
Or either way, if that case had been disposed of, one way or the other.
Well, I think the response to that would have been, if the case is now completed and the retention program gets announced, then I think the proper lawsuit is to bring this suit, say that because of discriminatory inputs, I have received either no retention bonus or a lower retention bonus, establish that, in fact, the lower inputs, the discriminatory inputs, in fact, suppress production, and then recover as an element of your damages the retention bonus. But the challenge remains to the underlying inputs, not to the program itself.
This retention program, did it begin with Bank of America, or was it underway before Bank of America made the purchase?
No, it was specifically designed and enacted and adopted in the context of the acquisition. So the weekend when the acquisition was being negotiated and ultimately sort of signed on Sunday, September 14th, people were actually already beginning to work for the very first time on a retention program, which is standard in the industry. In this era of considerable consolidation in the industry, obviously in the past on a much smaller scale than the Merrill Lynch Bank America acquisition, as cited in our brief and as cited by the amicus, everybody else came up with a retention program that looks, at least at the high level, like ours. Namely, the details may vary, how much money you give, how much is contingent on back-end production, all of those things. But all of them adopted a retention program that rewarded, not surprisingly, the most productive brokers more than the lower producing brokers. There's only so many dollars to go around, and even if there were infinite dollars, you would never give the lower producers the same as the more productive brokers. That's just not the way the business world works.
The intent allegations in this complaint are largely focused on the knowledge aspect of that inquiry, which is to say that the defendants adopted this retention bonus program with knowledge of the discriminatory inputs, to use your terminology. But there are some, at least generalized allegations, that they intended to retain and more generously compensate white financial advisors over African-American and female financial advisors. And why isn't it sufficient to allege intent generally post-Iqbal?
I think because the complaint needs to be read as a whole, and I think the complaint makes it crystal clear that, in fact, what they are talking about is that the intent flows from the tainted production credits and the alleged knowledge. And they've made that quite clear in their briefs as well. So, for example, at page 37 of their main brief, they say the complaint alleges that the bonus retention program discriminates against African-American FAs because Merrill Lynch and Bank of America chose to base the program on production credits that reflect Merrill Lynch's ongoing discriminatory acts. And at pages 18 and 19 of their main brief, they have a very similar statement. That clearly is the gravamen of what they have alleged as the intent. And I think the second reason why it is insufficient is because one needs to take a look at it in the context of whether it's plausible. I think that's the teaching of Iqbal and of Twombly. In Twombly, one had parallel conduct that was equally consistent with free market activity as with antitrust conspiracy, and that was insufficient. In Iqbal, you had conduct that was not necessarily on its face discriminatory given the context of 9/11. And I think
that was an individual inquiry, though, whether it was plausible that high officials in the United States government would have intended to discriminate against individual detainees, right?
Yes.
This is a systemic sort of a claim, and so I think the plausibility analysis or the plausibility question is a little closer in this case.
But I think it's very much like Tomeo. This court's decision in Tomeo, in which while the court sustained the sex allegations complaints because that was a plausible explanation for what occurred to her.
That was a First Amendment case?
And it also specifically rejected her First Amendment claim. And it rejected her First Amendment claim despite the fact that she alleged that she had testified before some legislative committee in her individual and not official capacity. And the court specifically rejected that allegation because given the context of the complaint and everything else that was alleged in the complaint, it was clear that what she had done was testify in her official capacity, despite that allegation in the complaint. And I think the same is very much true here. It's quite clear that what plaintiffs are alleging is not that individuals got together and somehow gerrymandered a system that disadvantages African Americans. Their allegation, and as Ms. Friedman's argument demonstrates, is about the tainted inputs and knowledge of that taint, alleged taint. That is what their case is about, and that's exactly what the Supreme Court has said is insufficient as a matter of law. I want to address briefly the Lilly Ledbetter issue. First of all, the language used by Congress in overturning the Lilly Ledbetter Act is exactly the same language it used to overturn Lawrence on the seniority system. It's all about the statute of limitations issue. And quite frankly, Ms. Ledbetter was not challenging the compensation system. What Ms. Ledbetter was challenging were the discriminatory performance reviews that she obtained outside of the statute of limitations period, which suppressed her current earnings. And that's exactly what she was challenging, and what Congress, in amending Title VII, has now allowed her to challenge. It did not seek to overturn 703H when it adopted the Lilly Ledbetter Act, just like it did not seek to overturn Teamsters when it adopted 706E2. in overturning Lawrence. The language of those two sections is virtually identical, and it's quite clear that what Congress was doing was allowing the present effects of past discrimination in certain circumstances to be actionable. It wasn't seeking to somehow dramatically alter three decades of Supreme Court jurisprudence and overturn the distinction that the Supreme Court drew in Teamsters and has reiterated many times since. It is a distinction between the program itself and the underlying inputs. I want to address briefly the issue that Your Honor mentioned, which is that in Teamsters, the fact that the seniority system was conceded not to have its genesis in discrimination. And that is that the Supreme Court has not hung its hat on that as time has gone on. Certainly in American tobacco products, it was not conceded. And the Supreme Court recently in the AT&T versus Hultin case had occasion to describe its holding in Teamsters. And in describing its holding in Teamsters, it said, "The seniority system in Teamsters exemplified a bona fide system without discriminatory terms. The discrimination having occurred in executive action, hiring employees, and assigning jobs. So the court could conclude that the system did not have its genesis in discrimination and has been retained free from any illegal purpose." So the Supreme Court, in considering its opinion and in relying upon its opinion in Teamsters, has not focused on that concession issue. Instead, it has focused on the very issue we're talking about here today, which is the distinction between inputs and the system itself.
Would you address the plaintiff's argument that this production credit system doesn't really measure the quality or quantity of production after all?
Well, the only reason that it doesn't measure quantity or quality of production is if one finds that, in fact, there has been discrimination in the way in which African Americans are allowed to achieve that production. But I would submit that there's no analytic distinction between that and the seniority in Teamsters. The seniority in Teamsters was quite obviously suppressed by the obvious and rank discrimination of the defendants in that case, which prohibited class members from being able to be hired and therefore earn seniority on the seniority lists. So quite clearly, one's ranking on the seniority list was suppressed in much the same way as production is suppressed here.
Well, does the system work in a similar way? In other words, is it basically a mechanical formula that sort of applies rotely, or is there some subjective judgment introduced into it, apart from the question of whether the inputs into the system were the product of discrimination? I understand. I get your point on that.
No, there's absolutely zero discretion. It is a purely mathematical formula. Two equally situated FAs selling 1,000 shares of IBM stock will receive the same production credits and will therefore earn and generate the same commissions and earnings at the back end in their paycheck. It is a purely mathematical formula.
Well, the weighting of the products that Ms. Friedman alluded to, mortgage products not receiving the same weight as stock products, for example.
Well, again, that doesn't go to whether the system is applied equally and to the same to FAs, black or white. Any FA who sells a mortgage product, black or white, will receive the exact same production credits.
But if, say, the African-American FAs tend to have more of certain products like mortgage transactions than sales, doesn't that build in a disadvantage?
Well, if in fact it does, then again, plaintiffs can obtain full relief by establishing that is discriminatory, that the earnings were the production credits were suppressed by reason of that, and the bonus retention program was a measure of their damages.
Is that formula based upon intrinsic evidence as to the value to the company of mortgage products versus stock products?
That would certainly be the testimony, Your Honor. I mean, Merrill Lynch is not the most profitable brokerage business in the world for no reason. It didn't gerrymander its compensation system in order to somehow disadvantage a small percentage, as Ms. Friedman constantly points out, the very small percentage of African Americans who may work for them. Rather, it's based upon quite obviously rational business judgments about what they want their clients, what they want their brokers to be selling, and what the value is to their company of selling those products. Thank you. We'd urge the court to affirm the decision below.
Thank you. Ms. Friedman, you had used all your time, but I'll give you 2 minutes in rebuttal. We asked you a lot of questions.
Thank you very much. I
hope not to speak too quickly to lose the point, but one case that we would cite that would follow the approach that we're recommending is Griggs, the seminal case in which the disparate impact analysis was developed. In Griggs, the question was...
703H is essentially an exception to disparate impact action under Griggs.
Griggs was analyzed under 703H, and the reason it was found not to apply to 703H was because the diploma requirement was not considered to be merit because it didn't measure what it purported to measure, which was qualifications for the job.
Right. So that's your argument, that this is not a true production-based compensation system because it's not measuring production.
It doesn't measure what it purports to measure, and so it pulls it out of 703H. With respect to the question of intent, there's been a lot of discussion this morning about whether our intent allegations focused on knowledge. I think it's critical to point out that when you're talking about a case like Feeney, where the requirement was a veteran's preference, and under the veteran's preference, they knew that women would be excluded at a greater rate, there's a disconnect between the knowledge of some other fact that's unrelated to the employer conduct and the conduct that the employer did. So this wasn't just knowledge that it would have an impact. This was knowledge that for 40 years they had driven this outcome. So what our allegations are is that Merrill Lynch wanted attrition to be higher for African Americans. It resisted the EEOC when it was required to hire African Americans, and the allegations are that after 35, 40 years of affirmative action, only 0.05% of the population of financial advisors are African American, and half reside in the lower 20%. We also allege that in the 6 to 9 category, there were zero in the first. So the question of plausibility under Iqbal is, if an employer developed a scheme to drive attrition for African Americans because it believed that its clients, its wealthy white clients, preferred to deal with white brokers, would it do it this way? Of course, and some of the evidence is that in addition to the retention bonus, on the back end there was a penalty box that was put into place that pushed out people in the fifth quintile. So our allegation isn't just that Merrill Lynch knew of the adverse impact, but that it caused it. And that's a critical, critical distinction, because that's the difference between tolerating past discrimination and perpetuating ongoing discrimination. So our allegation is this is all part of the same plan that's been going on for over 40 years to prefer whites. And Merrill Lynch wants to say, we interrupt this plan to announce you a legitimate, non-discriminatory job action, which is, now that we've created this mess of giving all the benefits to the whites and they're all at the top, well, of course, what's an employer to do but protect those whites that we've given all the benefits to? And our allegation is that under Ledbetter, you just created a new violation. And I think it's a wonderful question to ask, what if McReynolds 1 had been over? And the concession here, which is that McReynolds 2 could be filed as a challenge to the inputs, we would like you to ask, isn't that what we did? This complaint looks like every other complaint. It has jurisdiction, it has venue, it has a bunch of allegations, it has a prayer for relief. It is that lawsuit. We never brought a theoretical challenge to the notion of retention bonuses, incentive compensation, or anything of the like. All we did was seek losses for our clients based on a current compensation decision that was actionable under Ledbetter.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Friedman. Our thanks to both counsel for excellent arguments, and the case is taken under advisement.